Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. American classical music is in trouble. Financially strapped symphonies and operas cutting back, moving out, closing down. But if you're young, with a voice and a dream, and besotted with opera, it doesn't matter. You try. You compete for the stage. The biggest competition is the National Council Audition. Its climax, the Grand Finals at the Metropolitan Opera in New York City. Only a handful make it. American Idol has nothing on this gang. This hour On Point, we'll talk with judges and winners of America's top young opera competition. You can join the conversation. Have you dreamt of hitting the high seas and thrilling a crowd on stage at the Met? Do you know what it takes? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. And you can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We're going to hear from a terrific couple of winners in this year's competition in this hour. We're also going to hear from organizers and from the judging angle. Joining us right now from St. Louis is Galitha Nichols, former opera singer. She's now executive director of the National Council Auditions of the Metropolitan Opera. Galitha Nichols, thank you so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure, Tom.
And with us from New York is Brian Zieger, executive director of the Metropolitan Opera's Lindemann Young Artist Program and artistic director for the vocal arts program at the Juilliard School in New York City. He judged semifinals for this year's National Council Auditions. Brian Zieger, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Let's get just a little bit of the flavor. People have been watching you all for a long time, and of course you fill the house for the grand finals in this competition. In 2009, a documentary called The Audition was made about the competition. Many of our listeners may have seen it one way or another. Here's a little bit from that, where the judges discuss 22-year-old tenor and finalist Michael Fabiano.
Michael Fabiano.
Well, he's 22 years old.
Mm-hmm. He'll be 23 next month.
He's extraordinary.
I think he's got such the way he communicates.
He really does.
Yeah.
I mean, he
shouldn't bellow. And as you said, he's either going to be fantastic
or dead.
Or dead.
Or dead.
One
yeah.
or the other.
The way he goes up through the passaggio worries me a lot.
Fantastic or dead, he shouldn't bellow, but it's not exactly Steven Tyler and J-Lo there with the presagio. And here's a little bit more. The judge is talking about another contestant, Kira Duffy, 27 years old, soprano finalist.
Miss Kira Duffy was the first to sing. Opening comments?
Wonderful top.
Beautiful top, but you wonder in the size of our houses in this mm-hmm. country, mm-hmm. can this voice, right. you know, really project into a...
Right. I felt it was a real European voice.
It was just so vampy, too. So it was vampy for my case.
Well, that might have been her fault.
Vampy to vampy. You want to know what opera judges say to one another? We're going to hear in this hour from Ryan Speedo Green, 6'5", 300-pound, size 17 shoes, and did great in this year's competition. And Michelle Johnson, wonderful singer as well. Here they are just a few weeks ago backstage after their victory at the grand finals.
This whole week, my nerves are just so high. I was so nervous, and, you know, being amongst all these amazing singers.
I am trying not to cry. I'm so excited. It is a true dream to be in this position, so thank you.
Trying not to cry, but Michelle Johnson sounds great even when she's trying not to cry. Galitha Nichols, describe this competition for us. More than 1,000 in the early rounds. Where do those happen, and how do you winnow them down?
Yeah, they're way more than 1,000. We get close to 2,000 applicants every year. We have 42 locations around the country, which we call our district level auditions. So in 42 different cities around this country and Canada, we're hearing young singers. There's no screening process to that. That is the screening process. So if you're interested in opera, you want to become an opera singer, you can download the application. You're ready to do 5 arias for us, and we're going to hear you. And from that, we'll select a few. to move on to a second level, which we call the region finals. And we have 14 cities around this country where we hold the region finals. And that's just the second final of the competition. These two first levels are amazingly run by volunteers in each of these communities, people who donate their time, their energy, and certainly their money to make these things happen for young singers and for their community.
And we're talking all over the place, in Grand Forks and Philadelphia and Little Rock and Boston and all over the country.
Yeah, lots of big cities, but some very small cities, which is a great, great opportunity for those singers who go to schools and smaller colleges and universities.
Brian Zeger, you can't turn on the television these days without seeing that Americans like to sing and like to dance, look at all those competitions, and like to watch people do that. But opera, what is it that gets thousands coming out, young people, these days, to compete in opera competitions, Brian?
Well, you know, it's different for each young person, but something hooks them. I think Ryan Green in his New York Times Magazine interview said that he had the opportunity to come to the Metropolitan Opera to see a production of Carmen when he was a teenager, I believe.
Growing up very poor in Southeast Virginia, but he got that chance and just hearing that moment.
And, you know, the hope for us in the opera field is that at least enough young people get some kind of exposure to what this is, because there are those folks that just get hooked on this art form. I think they find it very expressive, very exciting, full of energy, full of self-expression, and they just get hooked. We see it all over from singers from all over the world.
Let's hear one of those. Michelle Johnson from Pearland, Texas, got her opera training early on at Boston University's Opera Institute. Sang terrifically there. And if we can listen for a moment to some of her singing, she was one of the 5 out of 8 who made it in the grand finals. And I'd love to hear you two think with us about her voice. Here she is singing Dove Sono from The Marriage of Figaro, Mozart. Michelle Johnson there singing Mozart. Galitha Nichols, I mean, it sounds terrific, but give us your tutored ear. What are you hearing that said to you, maybe the other judges, obviously, wow, she's in?
Well, you know, it's interesting. When you find out what they're going to sing, you, in your own mind, start setting up your standards, what you expect. Dove Sono, very, very difficult piece for any soprano. It's very exposed. And for a voice like Michelle's, I thought she did an amazing job on that Sunday afternoon. It takes such control, such skill. It's not just about the language and what she's saying, but how she spins it all together. And she was a mature artist that morning. She had the audience in the palm of her hand.
We always wonder about how the decisions get made, who's in, who's not. Michelle Johnson sounds fantastic there, but then a lot of them sounded fantastic to me, and they didn't. Not everyone made it. Here's another, Sasha, help me here, Galitha. I don't know how to pronounce her family name.
I need to look at it myself.
Dehanian, we'll call it.
Dehanian,
good. Forgive me, Sasha. Dehanian, but here she is singing Signore Ascolta. This is from Turandot, Puccini. Beautiful singing from Sasha Dehanian there. Brian Zeger, help us understand. Here she is with her offering before that packed house. She made it into the final 8 out of nearly 2,000, but not the final 5. What gets in her way?
Well, one of the things you have to think about is the match between what they offer and who they are. Sometimes you hear a very talented singer. I know Sasha. I like her work. I mean, in my estimation, this aria is probably one notch a little too heavy or a little too big for her. She handles it okay, but I think she's a little bit stepping out on a limb. So there's not only preparing and you know, getting your skills to where they need to be, there's also really knowing who you are and how you fit into the larger picture of the opera world.
So you might have said, choose another piece that highlights your strengths more effectively than this one?
Yes, I think, you know, she's a very charming artist. She's got a lot of energy. She's got a lot of spunk. A sustained piece like this, which is all about pathos, maybe does not play to her strengths the way something else, which is a little more comic, moves differently, mm-hmm. might.
Who you are, that's interesting, Galitha. I mean, it's more than technique, then. It is the personality of these singers that you're also weighing at some level?
I'm not weighing so much their personality, but their personality, just as Brian said, has to match up with the music. There's something that clicks when that's right, and we believe it completely. They are completely involved in what they're doing when it's something they identify with. I've often said to singers, you know, I think you'd be really great in the Fiordaligi aria or such and so, and they kind of look at me like, I don't get Fiordaligi. And I'm like, well, I never got her either. So, you know, I don't understand why she's having such a difficult time. And if you don't understand the character and what they want, you can't hook into that. You can't tap into that yourself. You can't sell that to an audience. You can't make them believe that you are that person.
Choose well if you're on that elite stage. It went from 8 to 5 after coming down from nearly 2,000 the grand finals of the National Council auditions. Galitha Nichols and Brian Zieger are with us today to look at it. We're going to hear from a couple of the winners, terrific winners as well. Nicholas Masters behind us here. He tried, didn't quite make it, but the effort is beautiful in itself. Have you dreamed of it, listeners? Singing in the shower, seeing your fine self center stage at the Met, belting out Rigoletto, Don Giovanni, Carmen, call us, 800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Quest'anima consola e ciolilar mi fa e giubilar e ciolilar mi fa e giubilar e giubilar mi fa e ciolilar mi fa e ciolilar mi fa. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Behind me there, Anna Trebko, very much in the opera world, one of the world's leading sopranos, performing there at the Metropolitan Opera last October from Donizetti. There are many, many aspiring young opera singers who haven't made it in and would love to. We're talking this hour about a kind of opera idol, the country's biggest annual competition for young opera singers, the National Council Auditions of the Metropolitan Opera, and what it takes to win. Galitha Nichols is with us. She joins us today from St. Louis, but she's executive director of the auditions at the Met. Also with us from New York is Brian Zieger, executive director of the Met's Lindemann Young Artist Program. He's artistic director for the vocal program at Juilliard. So he's right up there, was a judge in the semifinals of the National Council auditions this year. You can join our conversation this hour. Can you picture American Idol for opera singers? No TV audience, but a knot of very demanding judges. Have you made a run at it, at a life in opera? Have you competed in these auditions? Do you dream of it? What's your question on how to get there, how to get started? What do you hear in these contestants today? We're going to hear in a few minutes from a couple of terrific winners from this year's competition. Galitha Nichols, I'm looking down here at the winners, and 4 out of 5 are bass baritone or baritone. What is it with all the guys and the deep voices in the winner's circle this year?
Oh, you know, every year is different. In 2007, we had 4 tenors, and I thought that was extraordinary. I'm always lucky to have 1 tenor in any major competition at the end of the day. This year, it was a lot about low voices. I started to get that feeling around January when I was out hearing some of the regional finals. There were more and more winners in that low voice category. We don't have enough of those in our business, so I'm happy that it was a big year for Low Voices, and we learned about some new wonderful artists that are in the midst and of their development, and hopefully they'll be at the Met.
Well, is it just simply the best that you're looking for, or is this a kind of shopping expedition to fill the thin spaces in the upcoming ranks? We need more Low Voices, so that's what we're looking for.
It's not really a shopping expedition. Well, I think maybe some days it is. It's an identification system. The National Council is interested in identifying talent, vocal talent, artistic aptitude, their skill levels, all that comes together. And we're not looking for finished products per se, so that's how it's not a shopping list. I'm not the one looking for who's going to be singing in our season next year or the year after that. I'm looking for those who we can help continue supporting them to train them so that they can become the singers who the Metropolitan hires 2, 3, 4, 10 years down the road.
It's a long, tough road and a very, very tiny needle to thread. Let's go to our listeners, William in West Hartford, Connecticut. William, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hello, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to take a moment to tell you all about my experience when I auditioned for the Metropolitan auditions years ago in the mid-90s.
Okay, good.
I'm a little horrified by the horrible things you hear sometimes on American Idol kind of environment. And when I went in to do my audition, you know, I walked in, there was a panel of people there, they were busy writing things, and as I began to sing, they stopped writing, and they looked at me, and they listened carefully, and they even smiled. You know, they asked for a second piece, and they thanked me when I was finished. I walked out of there. I knew in my heart that I had sung the best I possibly could, and I look back fondly on that day as one of the best days in my life.
And what kind of feedback did you get on that day, William? If it wasn't that kind of catty, snappy American Idol stuff, what did you get?
I got the pleasure of their time, and when they smiled, and I think I saw somebody kind of nod their head, I knew that I'd gone and done what I needed to do. You see, I actually had a legitimate little career. About 25 years ago, you know, I was having a nice afternoon visit with a good friend of mine. We were both working in a show at that time in Western Canada, Ben Heppner.
Mm-hmm.
And we were both thinking about, do you really want to take a shot at a career that might or might not pan out? Well, it panned out for him big time.
Yeah.
But you know what? For me, I had like 25 professional contracts. I worked here, I worked there. I've transitioned into healthcare consulting, but I still have a contract to go and do a concert in Toronto next summer. I'm still studying in New York. I'm still watching my life get enriched by all of this. I'm a regular audience member at the Metropolitan Opera, and when a friend and colleague of mine is on stage, it's thrilling to hear them after all these years and see the beauty of that house coming together. It's changed my life in incredible ways, and the fact that they took the time at the auditions to listen to me and let me do my work and let me have that moment in my life, that's all they had to do.
William, it sounds like it's worked out tremendously, and I love that story. We're going to hear from a couple who are doing just that this year in just a couple of minutes here. Brian and Galitha, I hope you'll help us come to hear and understand these two a little better. Let's listen first here to a little bit more of Michelle Johnson. We heard a little bit of hers. This is a soprano, one of the 5 2011 winners in the grand finals here, the National Council auditions. Here she is in the competition with just a beautiful performance. Let's listen. Hear the crowd, never mind the judges, the crowd at the Met saying, Yes, to Michelle Johnson right there, and how beautiful that is. Beautiful, big, high note there, delicately put at the end. Let's hear just a little bit of another at the other end of the scale. Ryan Speedo Green, bass baritone, a big guy. We'll hear from him as well in just a moment. Here he is singing Rossini from the Barber of Seville, La Calunnia, in the grand finals of the National Council auditions.
Come un colpo di cannone, un tremoto temporale, un tremoto temporale, un tremoto generale che fa l'aria rimbambar. Un tremoto temporale, un tremoto temporale, un tremoto generale che fa l'aria rimbambar. E meschino calloniato a vinto calpestato sotto il pubblico facello per gran sorte va a trepar.
There, Ryan Green, Ryan Speedo Green. Brian Zeger, we talked a little about Michelle Johnson. Talk to us about Ryan, an imposing figure. We'll hear from him in just a minute. But what about the voice?
Well, the voice is big and rich. It's got a beautiful kind of natural glow to it. I was very taken by the sonority of his voice right from the first time I heard him. And the other wonderful thing about Ryan is his personality. He just jumps off the stage and makes an immediate connection with the audience.
Let's hear it. Ryan Speedo Green joins us right now from San Bernardino in California, one of the winners of the 2011 National Council auditions. Ryan Green, thank you very much for being with us.
Hello, how are you?
We're well. You remember that moment on stage when you were singing Don Basilio there? What were you thinking as you sang?
How this moment will forever be with me till the day I die.
Well, we're glad. I don't know if that's for good or ill. We'll talk about it. With us as well today from Philadelphia is Michelle Johnson, the wonderful soprano that we've heard a couple of times here today, also a winner in the National Council auditions this year. Michelle Johnson, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Congratulations to you and Ryan both on coming through this enormous competition. What does it mean to you as a young singer, Michelle, to make it through that eye of the needle?
Oh, wow. It is. I'm honored. It is such a long process for a lot of young singers. We try every year, and to finally make it, it is such a dream come true.
Do you know what comes next? Does it mean, you know, Hollywood contracts and recording contracts? Is this American Idol where suddenly you've got business to do, or you've got to keep on working at it, Michelle?
Oh, this is definitely not American Idol. we are not finished products, so I will just continue to study. And, but it's a wonderful tool to get the career started, though.
Ryan Green, your story was told at some length in the New York Times over the weekend. Daniel Bergner reporting there on the competition. Your background, big guy, 6'5", 300 pounds, size 17 shoes, grew up in a low-income housing trailer park in southeastern Virginia, you know, 12 years old and in juvenile detention. What was the thing that sparked you on the road that brought you to that spot on the Met stage, Ryan?
Well, I mean, a lot of things led to that, but probably the biggest moment for me, especially for wanting to be an opera singer, was my first time at the Met. I'd never been to New York prior to seeing a Met opera. A really important woman in my life, who they talk about in the article, my fourth grade special ed teacher, paid for me to go to New York to see opera at the Met, and I saw Carmen with Denise Graves and Placido Domingo, and I had orchestra seats. Like, you know, I did the whole entire experience, and never before in my entire life had I felt so many emotions in one evening. I cried, I laughed, I was angry, you know, and with the voices, like, that, you know, Placido and Denise telling me the story, I left literally a changed person. And I went back home to Virginia, you know, to my trailer park, and told my mom and told my voice teacher that I wanted to sing on stage of the Met one day. I was like, if I can sing on stage of the Met, like, my life will be complete.
And what? How did they respond back in the trailer park? Did they say you go, or you know, if there had been American Idol in those days, would they say, "Oh, forget about it, man"? You know, sing pop, sing pop.
Well, I mean, again, where I came from, my neighborhood, not many people even knew what Lincoln Center was.
Mm-hmm.
And so, for me to explain to them this event that was almost, you know, dreamlike, like being going to Disney World, for you know, that's the kind of feeling it was for me. And to explain that to someone who, you know, has no idea what it, what's involved, you know, they were just kind of like, oh, okay, you know, it's, you know, hopefully it'll happen. But my voice teacher at the time, he really saw that I had an interest and took upon himself to, you know, push me to be that type of artist. It was a long road, but, you know, he started me on that.
Yeah, well, congratulations on what you've accomplished there. Michelle Johnson, here you are. You're 28. You've been in the singing world for a long time. But outside of that kind of elite, high road singing world, do your peers in age understand what you're up to and why? Why you're singing opera in the year 2011?
No, they really, they don't get it. They appreciate it, but they don't I don't think they understand, like, the difficulty of our job. You know, we're entertainers, but it's a different type of entertainment.
And do they understand why you've gone for a classical form instead of using those beautiful big pipes of yours to, I don't know, belt out a Katy Perry tune?
I get that all the time. I get it all the time. They say, oh, if you were in popular music, you would be so famous and so rich now. To me, it's not about the fame or the money. It's about the art form. It is an amazing art form that I think that it should continue to be popular, and not just by belting, but lyrical line. Lyrical line is beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Brian Seeger, you know, it was an afternoon with Carmen or an evening that got Ryan in here, and you hear Michelle's peers, what they say to her. You're at Juilliard, so you see a lot of people in this river. What brings people of this age in their 20s into opera now? What is it overall? Is it, you know, some moment in a performance years ago, or I don't know, what draws them in?
Well, you know, what's interesting about the development of a classical singer versus, let's say, a classical pianist or violinist is that pianist or violinist has to start really young. Many of them start around 4, 5, 6 years old.
Yeah.
So in a sense, those instrumentalists have to be blessed with a family environment and a social environment which promotes that. Whereas classical singers, because they can't really train their voice intensively until they're through puberty, normally until they're more or less college age, they have a chance to get exposed to it through a whole variety of means. I think very often you hear the kind of story that we've heard from Ryan, where one very generous and visionary teacher will just introduce a young person to it, and the rest is history.
And Galitha, over the years, is the number who are trying out growing, shrinking? What's happening with it?
Well, this year we had more auditioners than ever, and I cannot explain that. Other than with the documentary of The Audition,
mm-hmm.
Lots more people have seen now a little bit about what we do, and so maybe they focused in on us a little bit more and said, well, I want to try that one. But there are more people in colleges and universities declaring majors in music and certainly in opera than there ever been.
So what is that about? Is it some kind of high-end American Idol effect? Because if you look at the business, operas and symphonies are in trouble. It's not as though, you know, opportunities for work are exploding.
Well, you know, no young college singer goes into this with the plan of how they're going to actually pay the rent. They
wow,
really
how do they
jump
do that?
In.
Most
they
people
really
need
jump
to.
In. Yeah, they jump in with both feet at the deep end because they love it, because mm-hmm. it's a calling, literally. They just have to try to do it. Now, you know, at some point it may not be happening, and for thousands of people that's exactly the way the life goes. But they've pursued it and they've taken it as far as they can. But many, you know, won't even stop at folks saying, I don't think this is for you, and I don't think you can really do this. If you have that inside of you, that drive, you'll find a place for yourself in classical music, whether it's on the opera stage or something else.
We're going to talk about that passion, that drive, with a couple of terrific young singers, winners, 2 of 5 in this year's National Council auditions at the Metropolitan Opera, 5 out of nearly 2,000 at auditions all across the country. Ryan Speedo Green is with us, terrific bass baritone, and Michelle Johnson, soprano. Brian Zeger's with us from Juilliard, Galitha Nichols from the Metropolitan Opera. You can join the conversation this hour. Have you competed in this kind of audition? Have you dreamt of it? Can you hear what the judges heard in these voices? The potential, the gift? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about the country's biggest annual competition for young opera singers, the National Council Auditions of the Metropolitan Opera, and what it takes to win in the grand finals. 8 out of nearly 2,000 make it there. Only 5 chosen this year, 2 of them with us today. Soprano Michelle Johnson and bass baritone Ryan Speedo Green. Also with us, Brian Zeger from Juilliard, also executive director at the Met's Lindemann Young Artist Program. He was a judge in the semifinals of the auditions. And Galitha Nichols, who's executive director of the auditions, joining us today from St. Louis. You can join the conversation. Can you feel what drives these young singers to Puccini, Rossini behind us here, Verdi, and not to Katy Perry, American Idol? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Deanna Braywick behind us here, singing from Rossini's La Comte d'Ores. She's singing the part here of Countess Adele. And Michelle Johnson, you know, here she is. She's singing at her brother's absence. He's off fighting the Crusades. She's taking a vow of celibacy until he returns. I mean, the content of opera definitely isn't about sort of, you know, you and me in a pickup truck on the road or, you know, the sort of pop music content. Is it a stretch? Do you have to read into the history to empathize, to feel the heart of these roles, Michelle?
Oh, yes. Yeah. You definitely have to do your research and really get to know the character and try to figure out how to make it your own. You know, my favorite opera is Il Trovatore, and let's talk about a story. That story is just so, so wild. But with the music and the text, it tends to make sense after a while.
And who would you sing Il Trovatore, and what's their
Leonora?
Piece? And what's her piece in the story?
Her piece is, she is a woman who is loved by two guys. She's loved by a count, and then she's also loved by a gypsy troubadour player. And she's in love with the poor gypsy tenor, and she is willing to give her life for the gypsy tenor in order for him to live. Then there's like this whole backstory of that the tenor is actually the baritone's brother, but the count doesn't know, and the mother like stole a baby, threw in a fire. It's a crazy, crazy story that just doesn't make any sense, but it's very compelling because Verdi pulled everything together with the music.
Yeah, Brian Green, what about the stories? What stories do you love best behind the opera that you sing? And does it help when you come into these roles, maybe in these very complex classical stories out of practically antiquity sometimes, does your life experience help? That special ed class, not to mention that wonderful teacher, that trailer park, that juvenile detention center, does all that come into play when you open your mouth on stage to sing into these roles?
Well, I have to say that, you know, things that happen to you, and especially, you know, as growing up as a child, you know, they definitely define you as, you know, define moments of in your life as an adult. So, you know, with the roles that I've performed, you know, mostly are, in a sense, most of them are comedic. And even My future roles that I, you know, want to perform, for instance, the Nozze di Figaro, like performing as Figaro in that Mozart opera, like is one of my biggest dreams. And to be the hero, to be a person who can thwart someone else's plan, who could manipulate my surroundings to turn into something good, is you know, inspiring to me, because even given your status growing up, you know, I didn't have, no one in my family was musical. I didn't have a lot growing up.
Mm-hmm.
I still had a dream that I wanted to be an opera singer, and with the certain things falling into place in my life, I'm on my way towards doing that. And you know, the character in the Nozze di Figaro, he's a servant, and the fact that he can thwart a count, you know, who is higher status, who has all the power over him, is just really inspiring to me, and something, you know, that only opera can do. So
living the dream, living the stories right there on the stage, that's fantastic. Let's go to our listeners again. Charleston, South Carolina. Courtney's calling. Hi, Courtney. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you so much for taking my call.
Uh-huh.
I just wanted to ask the kind of nature-nurture question and find out how much one is born with the talent to sing opera and how much training also goes into having that kind of voice.
That is a great question. Brian Zieger, let me come to you with it. And Courtney, thank you. Brian, look, just for example, at Ryan Speedo Green here, you know, what is it? Is it 6'5", 300 pounds, the pipes down in that throat, the vocal cords, or is it his life experience growing up and the nurture and sometimes maybe lack thereof that comes in dramatically to his capacity?
Well, it's definitely both, Tom. I mean, you have to be born with a marvelous voice, with a marvelous instrument, and with the kind of physical coordination that's going to make it possible to harness that instrument for an opera career. But then, absolutely, there's so much training is needed that you have to get the lucky breaks to get to the good schools or the good teachers. It's true that a lot of prominent performers have overcome a lot of adversity to get there, but somehow they have to have a kind of sixth sense about how to find the training they need, because the training is absolutely essential. So for your listener's question, it's both nature and nurture.
Galitha, weigh in here on age and how these things emerge over time. Brian talks about how great pianists, let's say, or violinists start quite young and sometimes peak quite young. But here we're looking at your finalists this year were ranged from 22 to 28 in Michelle's case. In some other art forms, they're already fully at the age where they would be, you know, well into very prominent roles, but in opera, I guess it just takes longer, Galitha. What's the maturation cycle?
Right. It takes a lot longer, and here's how: we're not American Idol. They're not lined up around the corner of the building waiting for a chance to sing. They've lined up around the world at their conservatories to get in and then work 4 years and then maybe two more for grad school and then another training program. And Michelle, being about, I think, 28 now, has been working on this nearly a decade, you know, in a serious way. And it takes that long. It takes about that long, unless somehow you're just so natural that somehow you can, at 22, 23, 24, really put enough together to get on stage of a professional house and then grow from there. But most of the young singers, and they are young singers in their 20s, it's going to take them a good 10 years to put this all together. There are just so many elements, and we're not born naturally in America into very many families that are bilingual. And let's face it, opera, if we're studying it and learning it from the ground,
Italian
roots,
and German, and
Italian,
maybe French,
German,
as well.
French. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And now the Russian repertoire is very much in the mainstream.
Mm-hmm.
It's incumbent on young American singers to figure out that language thing. And that's not easy for us if we didn't start hearing it young.
And the vocal cords themselves, Brian, do they take into the 30s to reach ideal, I don't know, maturity for this kind of singing?
Well, it depends on which vocal category you're in. As Galitha was saying, there are certain kinds of voices. For instance, Deanna Braywick, who we heard a few minutes ago, that's a kind of light, flexible voice where sometimes in their early 20s they can really do beautiful work. But a voice like Ryan's, which is a fuller category, and often he's going to play middle-aged men and older men as well in his voice vocal category.
Right.
So for him to come into his own in his late 20s or 30s, it would be quite natural and quite advisable professionally.
Let's get a call from Prestonsburg, Kentucky, and Michelle. Michelle, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'll try to be concise. I teach voice, and I wanted your guest to address this issue. it seems in the world of opera, there's this creeping issue that's coming in where there are young singers who, because of their voice and their looks, they're given contracts for roles that are perhaps too large for their voices. And there doesn't seem to be as much longevity in the careers of singers as there has been in the past. And I just would like your guests to address that issue and express their opinion.
Michelle, let me ask you, contracts for their voice, I fully understand. Presumably it's always been like that. But looks, are looks playing a bigger role in your perception, Michelle?
Yes, that's something that I've been perceiving in that. You know, I guess we can attribute this to the MTV phenomenon, where it's not just necessarily talent alone that might get you a contract, but also how you might look in that role. If someone has a better look for the role, they may be assigned it.
Let us pick it up. Ryan and Michelle, I'll come to you. I'll come to you all first, because in the big article that we read here, there's a lot of sort of backstage chatter about this and speculation about this. I mean, Ryan, you're an imposing guy at 6'5", and Michelle, I see you're gorgeous. But what about, Ryan, what do you think about looks in this business at this point?
I think definitely we're moving in a different direction than probably 40, 50 years ago, when it was literally, you know, all about the voice. You know, they didn't have HD broadcast back then.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, it's good to look the part as well as sing the part. And I mean, and there's so many singers these days that I think that's a possibility. You know, I, you know, being 6'5" and 300 pounds, you know, I'm not going to play, you know, probably not play, you know, the prince or some sort of character like that. I'll probably play a father or the bad guy or an uncle or some sort of comedic character. But I really think nowadays, yes, looks can be important, but I hope and, you know, that it's still mostly about the voice.
Michelle, when you look around, do you see that? You know, you've got some very lovely stars now. We heard Anna Trebko earlier. On the other hand, you know, there's pretty faces everywhere. A lot of opera, real opera lovers do come for the voice, but then it's a whole package. How conscious are you of the looks factor when it comes to this path these days, Michelle?
I'm pretty conscious of it, just because, you know, I guess, whenever you think about this, you always think about Miss Voight, Miss Debbie Voight, and the black dress. Okay, fine. But the deal is that we cannot forget the voice. The voice is what separates opera from other genres. You know, pop, you just have, you know, the look. Or musical theater, you have to go for that look. But yes, there is a certain thing. Yeah, present yourself well, but you have to think about the voice when it comes to opera. You just have to.
Galitha, there's a lot of chatter that for all the success of the Met's high-definition screenings around the world, I guess, at this point, the sort of close-up shots that have brought people in and really swept people away in those screenings also do put a premium on looks. I mean, in the media age that we're in, is that just the way it goes, Galitha? Is that going to be a part of the package more than in the history of opera?
I would be hard-pressed to say we're going to ever go backwards. I think we're just going to take this forward. It's multiple things. We are also not willing to sit, listen, and watch opera by people who don't act well. So it's not just their physical appearance, but if they don't have the skills to really portray those characters, well, you know, we've already moved on. We now demand that. It's not the minority of opera singers who can act, and like everyone's surprised about this. No, this is a requirement of the job now.
I should say the full auditions concert of those grand finals will be airing on a lot of NPR stations throughout this summer. You can check your local NPR page, web page, or listings for that. George in Salem, Massachusetts. George, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks, Tom, for taking my call.
Yes.
It's an interesting segue. Earlier in the show, you had mentioned the ability to sell a role, and now you were just talking about acting. And I'm wondering if there are roles or characters or performances that you can think of that you would advise young, you know, aspiring opera singers to kind of look at in terms of a character study and point out, say, this is a good acting, a good job selling role. For example, recently I saw Sandra Rodbanovsky along with Fox Struckman, and you watch Struckman as Scarpia, and there's just no doubt in anybody in the audience's mind that he is the villain and he sold that role. So are there roles and performances like that that you could tell it, you know, if you're going to say, hey, there's a character study, and if you want to learn what I'm getting at, see this performance, see this role.
George, let us pick it up. Brian Zieger, are you backstage between performances talking with these young singers and saying, look, if you want to step up and really succeed, here's the role for you. It puts your voice and your look and your personality all together. Is that part of it, Brian?
Well, I wouldn't say that there are certain roles that are musts. It's all about a match between the singer's talent, the singer's temperament, their imagination, and the role itself. There are certain young baritones that can portray Scarpia the way Strukman does. Another one who has actually a marvelous voice may never find his way to Scarpia. It's about acting training. It's about understanding who these characters are, the same way that, you know, young aspiring actors, one may be a Hamlet, one may never succeed with Hamlet. It's that match between the personality of the performer and the role.
Ryan,
that's what we're always looking for.
Yeah, Ryan Speedo Green. Where did you get that middle name? We may see it up on a marquee one day. Where's Speedo come from?
Well, Speedo comes from my father. I'm one of five boys, and I was number four out of five. Mm. And so my father got to name me, and he is considers himself a comedian of sorts. And I was born April Fool's Day. So as a joke, my father named me, because he was a bodybuilder at the time, named me after his favorite underwear as a joke. So I guess I kind of just rolled with it, and it's, you know, made me an individual, and no one ever forgets it. So.
Don't tell me you wore Speedos for good luck at the auditions.
If I told you that, I'd probably have to tell you.
Well, Ryan, what's your dream? What would you like to sing in what location if you had the chance, Ryan?
Of course, my dream, you know, was to be at the Met, and, you know, I hope to see that realized. And, you know, my dream role probably is, as I said, La Noce de Figaro as Figaro. That is the bread and butter of bass baritone rep, and it's where we get to, you know, we have an opera named after us. So,
yes.
You know, it's a big kahuna of bass baritone role for me.
Well, you are a big kahuna. We'll wish you luck in that and hope that we hear and see it one day. Ryan Speedo Green, one of the five winners of the National Council auditions this year. Thank you very much for joining us from San Bernardino today, Ryan. Michelle Johnson, it's been wonderful having you as well. Dream role, dream location, Michelle, where would you put it? What would it be?
I have to be just like Ryan. The Metropolitan Opera is the place to be. Dream role is Leonora and Il Trovatore one day. I'm praying and hoping.
One day, and we wish you the best of luck with that as a finalist this year. You're on a good path. Michelle, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Behind us here, Michelle Johnson from The Marriage of Figaro once again. Brian Zieger, you've been very generous with your time and insights today, and we're so grateful for it. Thank you for joining us.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
Brian Zieger from Juilliard and Galitha Nichols from The Met. Thanks. It's been really fun. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Listeners, thank you for being with us today. We'll go out with a little more Michelle Johnson, just to savor. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thanks for joining us.